Hello and welcome to Cruise Club. We've got the Need to podcast. This is episode 26, Collateral from 2004. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
And with us tonight, Mike, if you listen to our Hanks for the Memories, big news, actually, that our main man, Tom Hanks, two things. Golden Globe nominations came out.
Oh.
He is going to be getting, I think this was maybe announced before, he'll be getting the Cecil B. DeMille, I think Lifetime Achievement Award, but also received the Best Supporting Actor nomination for A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. So very big news, very big week for Mr. Tom Hanks.
Excellent.
The reason I bring that up is because if you listen to Hanks for the Memories, last week's episode about Apollo 13, we looked to the space, we looked to the heavens, and we found a guest. And he is back with us again as we traverse the streets of Los Angeles. I would have bet so much money that this movie took place in New York, just like with my vague recollections. Like, a taxicab movie. Definitely New York. With us tonight to straighten me out geographically is Tobin Addington. Hello, Tobin.
Hello, and it ends in a subway, which is not something you think of with Los Angeles.
Right?
So, yeah. You'll be forgiven for thinking it's New York.
Before we get too far into Collateral, let me do a quick plot summary. This might be the easiest plot summary.
Really?
That I think, because I'm going to skip a bunch of it. So, Jamie Foxx is a cab driver, picks up Jada Pinkett Smith, who is a high-profile lawyer, tomorrow starts a big case, lets her out, picks up Tom Cruise, the leading actor in this movie, even though he and Jamie Foxx basically both should be lead actors. We'll get into that.
Mm-hmm.
Jamie Foxx nominated for Academy Award and Golden Globe for Best Supporting Actor, lost both of those. However, won Best Actor for Ray. So this is a big year for Jamie Foxx. Jamie Foxx picks up Tom Cruise. He says, "You bring me to all five stops tonight. Here's $600. Another $100 to bring me to the airport in the morning." Jamie Foxx brings him around. First stop, dead body falls from a rooftop onto Jamie Foxx's cab. He quickly realizes that Tom Cruise did that. Tom Cruise is a bad, bad man. And the rest of the movie is him bringing Tom Cruise against his will from location to location as Tom Cruise systematically takes out basically every high-profile informant and cog in this case, with the final person he's supposed to kill being Jada Pinkett Smith. Jamie Foxx then goes to her place of work, kind of rescues her, shoots Tom Cruise through the face. There is a chase to the Los Angeles subway. They have a confrontation. Jamie Foxx shoots and kills Tom Cruise. Permadeath here, Mike. We have actually Tom Cruise dies on screen.
Stays dead.
Second one, Taps dead too.
Oh, my bad.
It's been a while.
Jamie
Foxx and Jada Pinkett Smith leave. Movie ends. So there's a lot of things that happen in here, but basically, it's just them going from place to place. Tom Cruise being a ruthless, efficient, badass killer, and Jamie Foxx being like, "Please, won't someone help me?" I think it's a pretty straightforward movie,
yeah,
but also really, really cool.
I'd only seen this movie once before in its entirety, and I wonder if I hadn't rewatched it because I didn't want to, like, spoil, like, what a great experience that was. But, like, luckily, no. Like, I had just as great a time watching it for this show. But, like, man, this movie is lean and mean and super tight, maybe a little too tight at times, not to its detriment or anything to the point where it's unenjoyable, but I'm just maybe coincidence-wise and stuff. But, yeah, man, I love everything about this, and like I'm sure we're going to talk about how it was shot and the look of this thing and how much that adds to what's going on with the chemistry between these actors. And this is just two guys like acting their ass off in this movie together, and they fit so well. I can't say like enough right now. Like, I gotta collect myself. Someone take over.
I really wonder if this is a movie that people know about. Like, I know people know about this movie, but I think in the pantheon of Tom Cruise movies, I don't know that this one is especially known for two reasons. Number one, when I was looking for the art that I'm going to make for the episode on cageclub.me, the picture that I found from blog post was called "Why Collateral is the Best Tom Cruise Movie Nobody Talks About." Point one. Exhibit one, if I'm Jada Pinkett Smith. Exhibit one. Exhibit two, no one that we emailed, none of our friends, signed up for this episode. We had to recruit Tobin. I don't know if Tobin, if you didn't sign up for this one because A, you didn't click it, B, you thought you signed up for too many, but no one, not a single person of the 30 or so people that we emailed signed up for this movie. And we were like, huh. But then on a handful of earlier Cruise Club episodes, you had been talking about how much you love this movie. We're like, oh, we've got to get him on here. But I don't understand why people don't know this movie. I agree with you, Mike. I think this is one of Tom Cruise's better movies, cooler movies, better performances. One of, I think, maybe three movies where he's the villain.
Mm-hmm.
It's Taps, where he becomes the villain, Interview with the Vampire, and this movie. There might be more, but I don't think
and,
so.
And this
but
is
like,
way more of like a modern take on like a hitman villain. Kind, you know, like yeah. This is a real deal against persona type of role for him.
But Tobin, why don't we go to you first? What do you love about this movie? What is your favorite part of Collateral? Why do you love talking about this? Is this a movie that you show or have shown in film classes? What about this do you love?
Oh my gosh. So let me start.
No pressure.
Let me start by saying the reason that I did not sign up for it is because I was signing up for a bunch of movies and I didn't want to take one that I thought, okay, somebody else can do Collateral because surely there'll be a bunch of people who will want to do Collateral because who wouldn't want to talk about Collateral and watch it again and enjoy it? So I was trying to leave room for other people and I feel bad for them that they have not seen this movie, or maybe they felt the same way. Maybe they were also holding back. I love this movie in so many ways. I come into this movie as a Michael Mann fan. Michael Mann is the director of this movie. He's a filmmaker I've always loved. Thief, Manhunter, Heat, The Insider, and then on to Miami Vice. And he's a very kind of masculine filmmaker. He makes, by which I mean he makes films so very often about men. The women are usually sidelined, which is a thing that I, in general, I have a hard time with in movies. But I think he understands something about masculinity and is interested in kind of unpacking it in curious ways. And then this movie is so, the other thing is so cool about Michael Mann movies for me is his intense research. So he'll go into, you know, if he's going to make a movie about a cab driver, he's going to go drive a cab, you know, he's going to go hang out with the people who do it. He's going to go like sink into the minutia of how things get done. You can sort of feel that coming through this movie. Like, so if you just said the premise to somebody, a hitman picks up a cabbie and sort of hijacks him for the night to go on all this, on this crime spree, that could be a really cheesy straight to streaming thriller or whatever, with sort of nothing to it, right? But this movie invests so much in the characters and the world that they're in, and makes it as believable as possible, from the criminals to the police. The performances are fantastic, and I have a lot more I could say, but I will leave it there and let somebody else take over. I love this movie so much.
Is there one part that's your favorite? Like, is there one element of this that stands out for you above the rest, above everything else in this movie?
Knowing that this was going to be one of our conversation points, I kept looking. I had one in mind, which is the coyotes. And then I kept looking for, okay, I'm going to see. And then moment after moment went by, and I'm like, oh, that scene. Oh, no, that scene's the one. Here's what I think crystallizes this movie for me. There's a scene kind of in the middle of this movie where Tom Cruise tells Jamie Foxx, like, let's take a break. We're ahead of schedule. Let's go hear some jazz. And they go to a jazz club, and it's this great jazz club, and they have this conversation about Miles Davis with the trumpet player afterwards, the guy who owns the club. And then at the last minute, there's this reveal that, you know, Tom Cruise lets a name drop, and the guy's like, oh shit. And then Tom Cruise kills him in the middle of his own club. And it's this beautiful, what feels like it's just a character scene ends up also being a plot scene, but you get some sense of kind of the sadness and the world weariness and the compromised choices and the way that, you know, life doesn't work out the way you expect it to. All of this stuff is wrapped up in that one very surprising scene that I love so much. So that would be my pick for kind of best moment in the movie.
Yeah, that's really great. You know, this is really kind of like a lonely movie in a lot of ways, right? About like lonely people like meeting up and crossing paths, and it's weird. I know this sounds like cliche because it said so much about New York, but in New York as a character, but like LA is such a character in this movie, and you could tell Michael Mann just loves that city. And if I'm not mistaken, they're shooting this all on digital, right? Like, this was an experiment for Michael Mann to say, like, I need to shoot this movie at night. I'm in love with LA at night with the lights and everything. And so the available lighting and the digital technology and the filmmaking here, and what seems like a lot of sort of run and gunning, you know, even them being, you know, major Hollywood film, a lot of this just feels super loose and rough and just adds so much to like the dimension of it all and everything. And so, yeah, there's just like so many aspects of this movie that jump out that are just so good and add to every scene.
Have either of you seen the documentary Los Angeles Plays Itself?
No.
No.
So there's this movie that came out a handful of years ago that I saw at a draft house when I was living in Austin. I think it's since made its way to Netflix. But there was this movie that I think for years and years got sort of shuffled around because it was just, it took clips from all these different movies, and I think there were rights issues. But basically, it's sort of, you know, like you were saying, like how New York is the fifth character in Sex and the City. Like, there's all these, like, whatever jokes about, but it's true, right? Like, it just, like, when you have a New York movie that is very inherently a New York movie, there's a feel to it. And I think the same is true about Los Angeles. This movie in Chinatown, in Under the Silver Lake, whatever you're talking about, there's a, I think it's a, maybe possibly more diverse. There is a movie called Los Angeles Plays Itself, and it's kind of a journey through film history in movies where it's set in Los Angeles, where Los Angeles is important to the story. I would recommend checking it out. I don't remember if this movie's in there. I'm sure that it is. This movie feels so importantly Los Angeles. Like, I think there's a lot of it, like the cab element, the subway element, that feel inherently New York, but the way they get from place to place, the sort of the free space, the blank space in between, the ability to run around, the sort of absence of people, I think is something that you would never be able to really have in New York. I think it's something that you kind of only have to have in a city, maybe possibly like Los Angeles at night. I don't know. But I think the movie is fascinating. I think it's transport from New York to LA. This was originally set in New York. Oh. And then when Michael Mann came on, he shifted the script to Los Angeles. So I think he had a vision. Like you were saying, Mike, you know, he's in love with Los Angeles at night. The digital element has like a, it adds like a look. And I don't remember, I was reading a trivia thing. I don't know if it was something he was saying or a critic, but it was saying about how this was like the first digital film or one of the very first digital films that like used the digital look to have a look, to invoke a feel, right, as opposed to just shooting for the economy of it all. And this does feel like he's got a very uncomfortable way. And I'm sure, Toby, you can explain it better than I can, but like the super close-ups, the weird kind of angles, the jar, like the, it, everything just feels a little uncomfortable, a little bit off, but it works here because like you're supposed to feel uncomfortable.
At the time this movie came out, I was in the middle of film school. At our grad school, there was a, like this whole switch to digital was a real sort of controversial subject. And there was all this, I remember purists saying, you know, all digital looks like shit. Why would anyone ever shoot anything on digital? Sort of the way that Nolan talks about it today. And then you had other people who were sort of evangelizing it. One of the things that I remember the conversation about this movie talking about was the fact that, as you say, it's not trying to look like film. I think that was in the early 2000s when they would be using digital video cameras and try and make it look like film is when it would look the most bad. Like we hadn't learned how to light for digital yet. We hadn't learned how to use digital cinematography in a way that sort of supported the right kinds of stories. And also the technology, you know, obviously changed a lot just in the next 5 years after this movie. This is a movie where, as you say, the aesthetic choices made in terms of being able to see into the distance at night, being able to sort of get in these impossibly close places, being able to shoot so much footage because you could shoot really quickly. You didn't have to light it as much. You didn't have to take as much time. You didn't have to load film. And it wasn't as expensive. It was cheaper to shoot on video. So they were able to get all these shots. I mean, there's more, you know, and I think eventually the detriment of some of Michael Mann's style, sometimes things begin to feel overshot after this movie. But I think it's pretty pitch perfect here. But it was kind of contentious at the time. Like, is this really the future? Do all movies have to look like this? And the answer, of course, is no. But this one did blaze a trail.
I was watching this movie with all of that kind of in mind because I knew from the first go around, like, the history of the film and, like, you know, the way it was made and everything like that. And I was wondering now, like, can this possibly be considered like an experimental film for the time that it was made in? And
I mean, it's a $105 million experimental film, but we could say that.
No, but I mean, in the sense that, like, you know, The Phantom Menace is like an experimental film for CGI technology, like in the way that a lot of this is built around the technology that it is used to make, you know, so like they know they're going in there with these certain types of cameras and stuff, and so everything is sort of revolving around that, and then in that sense it just feels like a big experiment of like, okay, how far can we push these cameras, like where can we put it, like, you know, like you're saying about the style, like can we define a new style of cinema, can we put a new look to it, like to the silver screen and all this stuff, and like, I mean, not in the traditional sense of like crazy experimental stuff that makes no sense or, you know, that is like way out there and surrealism or anything like that, but just in the regard of that, it's trying to do like what the mainstream is doing in a very consumer way, you know, like he's doing this in a way that like we could have in a lot of ways, like these are the cameras essentially that were available when I was being taught by Tobin basically or like in film school and such, and you know, Danny Boyle was using this kind of stuff and not trying to hide it either, right. Saying this is the tech, this is how it looks. So I mean, that kind of thought crossed my mind watching it, and kind of just like added a lot to the allure of it being like, oh, this is digital, is an art form, you know, people can say film this, film that until the end of time, and like I don't disagree, but I also agree that there's merit to the digital style, look, and form, and you can do stuff that you can't do any other way. So I think this film is a testament to that kind of thing.
I mean, not to further sort of derail this from the talk about actual Collateral, but I don't know when else we'll be able to talk about this unless we ever do a Cinemakers for David Lynch, but I don't know that we're going to do Cinemakers for David Lynch. I would like to, but, you know, there's other things going on. David Lynch has a digital style that, like, if it was anybody else, I would hate, and I still kind of hate it, but, like, I know he's doing it for a reason, and I think that there's always something interesting to think about, and even if you're not able to I don't know that I can really fully articulate. I know the benefits of digital filmmaking is what you said before, Tobin. It's about, you know, economy. It's about the different, you know, lighting depths and all this different stuff and all that. I understand that on some level, not on a deep level, but on a sort of a shallow level. But there's like the thing like David Lynch, like with Inland Empire and Twin Peaks: The Return, where it like kind of intentionally looks bad. Like, I don't know. It doesn't look pleasing to the eye always. Maybe that's a better way to say it. Not that it looks bad, but it's just like, I don't know what's happening. And I feel like here it's the same kind of thing where it's like, it doesn't look beautiful, but it looks beautiful. Like, it looks specifically chosen for this look, for this feel, for this aesthetic, but it's not traditionally the way that you would expect a movie like this to look. And it just, it's jarring, but it's impressive. And I don't know, I wish that I was able to appreciate it more, but I think kind of the point of it, or I guess this is more of a question than a statement, is the point of this to make you feel, like it's to make you feel kind of like icky?
Well, I think in part of what digital does is it like there's more of like a clearness to some of it, right? And so like maybe you're just picking up on the vibe of the dirt on the street more or something like to that effect. I mean, it's a thing that I think high frame rate does in a poor way, where it, you know, shows you exactly sort of what's there in a way that film can sort of hide
Gemini Man look.
Oh my goodness, that is just so hard to watch.
Stay tuned for Ang Lee Cinemakers in 2028.
But I mean, say like intentional or not, I think that's that was a good side effect for what went on, because I think that feeling fits the tone of this film. You know, you want it to feel icky, like this is a dirty city at a dirty, you know, time of night, and he's doing dangerous and dirty things. So
yeah, I've come to really love the look of this movie. We should know that this wasn't entirely shot digitally. There are some scenes in Super 35. I think the jazz scene is one of them. I don't think that's video. I think that that's 35. But the look that it's remembered for is this kind of grainy, scuzzy look that I think keeps us off balance and keeps us sort of, I find it hard. I think the way you're saying it, Joey, is really good, that it is, it's like ugly beautiful. Like the beauty isn't in its sort of pristineness, it's in its messiness, which is true for so much of the movie too, that it's the messiness against which Tom Cruise's character's strict rules kind of play against. And I think that sort of marries aesthetically that character and the sort of the themes of the movie with the way it was shot.
Because he is like a slick, sleek, professional hitman. Mm-hmm. Right? He is the guy who, like, he is sort of the digital. Like, he is just ruthlessly efficient. He can do, you know, pardon the what sounds like a sex metaphor, he can go all night. You know, he can just, he's able to do everything. Like, he's like, I got five stops. I got six, like, you know,
he's
kills
a Terminator.
16 people. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, yeah, he literally turns into a Terminator at the end here, basically. But, like, he's able to do exactly what he needs to get done. Oh, I think the only time we ever see him reload is at the very end when he realizes he reaches in to reload, then he's like, oh no, this is the end of me. Like, you don't have to reload a digital camera. I guess you have to put in a new SD card or whatever. But, like, he is basically the epitome. Like, he's digital filmmaking in a killer, which is weird.
That's pretty cool. I didn't think of that before, because I was just thinking about how precise they both are in their professions, and they've clashed. So there's, like, only room for one. Like, only one can be super precise. And so at the end, Jamie Foxx wins out. And he'd been winning bets all night. So, you know, I banked on him anyway. No, that's a great point, I think, Joey. You could definitely, like, elaborate on that somehow. That's great.
And for people who don't know how the bet on digital cinematography won out, like, almost everything you watch today is shot digitally. Very few things are shot on film anymore, and if they are, they're usually by people who have enough clout to be able to do that. So your Tarantino's and your
Paul Thomas Anderson,
Christopher Nolan,
famously, yeah. And then you have everybody who's either not making a big deal of it, or people like Soderbergh, who's doing it kind of, or David Lynch, who's doing it kind of
iPhones,
iPhones, right. So this is like, this was in at the time, this felt like a, which way is this going to go? And in retrospect, it's like, no, this was going to happen no matter what. Like, this was just coming. And it took someone of Michael Mann's stature at the time, coming, you know, sort of after winning, you know, or being nominated for Oscars for multiple movies, to be like, no, I'm going to try and do this now. I think there's a way to use this technology, and he did here.
I think what's really telling, too, is his next movie, I think, was Public Enemies, and he, again, shot it, I think, entirely on digital that time, and it did just not work. You know, for a period piece of gangster films and stuff, I'm sure he was like, hey, let's, you know, let's just apply the same formula because, you know, efficiency, cost, whatever, and it just did not fit or work. I remember that being a problem for me watching that movie. So, you know, I think it does depend on the material, it depends on period, and it was like a nice marriage here that just worked out really well.
You mean the Channing Tatum vehicle Public Enemies?
Is he in that? The Johnny Depp was in that, right?
Channing Tatum is killed within 10 minutes of that movie, and that movie is like 2 hours and 20 minutes long. But yes, Channing Tatum is in that. We have an episode of it over on Magic Mike's, if you want to go check that out. Mike, did you pick a favorite part? Did you pick a favorite moment in this movie?
No, not yet. I mean, I did sort of bring up the look of the film earlier, but I mean, it's kind of cheating to pick Tom Cruise as your favorite part of and everything. But I have a real one, but I just have to say, we haven't mentioned his look yet, like the gray hair. The 5 o'clock shadow, like this is like totally bizarro Tom Cruise look, you know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. Not that he's trying to hide, but he's definitely trying to say, like,
well, he is trying to hide. I don't mean to interrupt you, but that's perfect, because the coolest trivia that I've ever read in IMDb is that the whole point of Tom Cruise's character essentially is that he can go in, go out, not be noticed, get the job done, move on, right? Like, he's sort of a chameleon.
He's a ghost.
You know,
and he's literally
Fast and Furious, he is Han. He is just, he can blend anywhere. To help him get into character, Michael Mann, supposedly, had him deliver FedEx packages in Los Angeles and have to get good enough at it to not get noticed, being like, oh, whoa, why is Tom Cruise delivering my package?
Cool.
So what you said, like, he is literally not trying to stand out. Like, he is trying to blend in and not look like himself. And I think it is working impeccably.
Yeah, I love his look, and he's using it so well in this movie. But guys, my favorite part, I think, and I remember this from the first time, I think this was actually the first time that I remembered to remember who this actor was when I saw him in a movie, but Mark fucking Ruffalo.
Yes.
God damn it, in this movie, he's so great, and when he gets shot, I'm so pissed, because I forgot that. I just want one clip of him at the very end to come back, you know, because everything is so tightly knit in this movie. I want Peter Berg to, like, show up with flowers at his hospital or something, but Ruffenberg, like, when they're together on screen, as like, oh my god, Ruffalo is just so good in this. He's so badass, and he's like in his own movie for most of this movie, and
yeah,
I love his look. I love just like how smart his character is, and you know, Joey and I bring up how dumb cops are all the time, and I mean, it's a trademark, you know, you just can't have a smart cop. But here Ruffalo, like, immediately he's like, hey, remember that case a few years back where like the cabbie drove around and killed 3 people then himself, and what if there was another guy in the car, and what if this is that? And I was like, oh my god, that's awesome. I'm so glad the movie, like, had the guts not to dilly-dally with any of the, like, police work and shit. And so, like, man, when he showed up on the scene, I was like, oh damn it, yes, I'm so happy he's in this movie. That was really something.
I was loving him too. I was glad that he did not come back at the end, because, like, 2 things. Number one, my favorite thing in this as Tom Cruise as a whole, in the type of role that we have not seen before, that I think we have been talking about most of this episode so far, we will continue to talk about him in the villain role. But number two, my favorite part of this, I think my favorite sequence, is that club scene. The club scene is just so cool.
Yeah.
The sound mixing is so good. Like, the gunshots are so loud.
It's like John Wick, right? Like, pre-Wick. Yeah.
Tom Cruise punching a guy and then snapping his neck and then stomping on his neck. Like, it's just brutally efficient. But in that club scene, as things are going on, Tom Cruise is taking out handlers and bodyguards and men to get down to the final guy. And Mark Ruffalo is there, and he knows, like, Jamie Foxx, I think, thinks, like, Max thinks he's going to have to explain himself, like, I'm not the guy. Like, they think he's the guy, right? And he's like, I'm not the guy, I'm the cab driver. And Mark Ruffalo's like, look, I know. Like, let's get you out of here. And he brings him out, and you're like, finally, you'll win for the good guys. And then they get out, and then Tom Cruise shoots and kills Mark Ruffalo. And from the way it was shot, or maybe I just didn't see it right or whatever, it seemed like he was not as tactically efficient, as precise as he had been. Like, the reason that Mark Ruffalo kind of links all these things together is because when they go to the morgue, he's like, there's the two, like, it's like kind of the military shooting, right? There's
the
two in
the
chest.
Tap. Yeah.
Yeah, and the one in the brain. It didn't, to me, look like Ruffalo had taken those kind of shots. It looks like he kind of got shot, like, in both shoulders or something. And I was like, is he going to, like, I kind of hope that he doesn't come back because it would feel like a cheat that Tom Cruise is supposed to be perfect, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad that he doesn't. And the only reason in the end, again, from IMDb trivia that I did not notice, but I love this little element. The reason that Jamie Foxx is able to kill him just sort of spraying and praying, as opposed to Tom Cruise, a professional hitman, is because as the subway doors close, where that double tap and where the brain shot would be is a metal bar in the middle.
Oh,
so Tom Cruise's
reaction.
Specific aiming hits the metal, and Jamie Foxx is just like shooting everywhere, and he just catches one bullet, luckily hits Tom Cruise.
Uh-huh.
But I was glad that Mark Ruffalo didn't come back. Like, I love him in this movie. I was like, is he playing a Mexican character? Like, oh no, he's just undercover. Thank God. Like, that would have been maybe a little problematic. But I'm glad that he didn't come back. Like, I loved him. I'm right there with you, Mike. But I'm just glad he didn't come back because it would feel like Tom Cruise is perfect except for this one convenient plot point.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Plus, it also gives the movie something of its own, right? Because like in a generic cop thing, like he would survive, but like this is collateral. He's going to stay dead and he's not going to show back up. And it's like, oh, well, you know, like it's not his movie after all. Like we're going to continue on without him. And I still love that about it, too. It's just like such a, oh, it's just one of those moments, you know, it's like when it's like you just expect that guy to last, you know, you just expect him. He's so smart and cunning and like resourceful and boom, like, yeah, he just gets taken out. It's like such a, oh, it's one of those great groaner moments.
Yeah. Mike, to your point, one of the things that I love about Michael Mann movies is that they're very often about people who are really good at their jobs. And what that means is that everybody on both sides or multiple sides of whatever the story is like they're the best at what they do. So in The Insider, you have Lowell Bergman, who's like the Al Pacino character, who's the best investigative journalist ever, and you have the corporate guys were the best corporate guys ever, like famously in Heat, where you have the cops and the robbers both being sort of following them both, kind of like you are in this movie a little bit, like they're both the best, right? Both teams are the best at whatever the cost that is to the rest of their lives. And that's true here too, that even outside of the main pair of Jamie Foxx and Tom Cruise, you have the Mark Ruffalo, Peter Berg cop contingent who some of whom are actually very, very good. And even if they're not the best, they're really competent, right? So which means that then what happens is that you set up the stakes get raised because you know that anybody could be really good at what they do. And so anybody could stop the other people, right? It's not like you're not just creating star characters to knock them down. And I think that's something that comes through really well in all different kinds of ways. Jada Pinkett Smith too, who he has to get rescued at the end, which is kind of a bummer, but she's like the reason she has to get rescued is because he wants to kill her because she's such a badass prosecuting attorney, right? So she's really, really good at her job too. And that's what so many of the conversations that they have in this movie are about, how they do their jobs and what their jobs mean and what the cost is to the rest of their lives and what it means to do your work well and all that. So I think that comes through in all the characters here.
They do it so effortlessly early on during that conversation with Jamie Foxx and Jada Pinkett Smith, and then almost the same type of conversation when Tom Cruise gets in the car, but about how Jamie Foxx knows the city and he can time him and this and that. And it's like, I didn't even realize they were setting up the idea that he's the best cab driver. You know, like, it's just so subtle in that way. And then, obviously, I mean, it's kind of funny. Like, I instantly just assume Tom Cruise is the best hitman on the planet. I mean, especially when, like, Jason Statham bumps into him and has to say, excuse me. I wasn't sure if that was, if they were working.
It's apparently a shout-out to the transporter.
Okay, because I wasn't sure if he was, like, exchanging, like, briefcases in a public place by pretending not to know each other. But, okay, yeah, because it's,
I think also
like,
that. Like, it's a two for one. Right. It's like a, this is his transporter, and it's also he's giving him the correct bag or whatever.
It would be really cool if they do like a transporter prequel with Tom Cruise and Jason Statham or a flashback or some shit.
That actually might be my least favorite part of this movie, is that Jason Statham's in one scene and then never comes back. It's like, come on, man, don't tease me like that.
No, I hear you. It could be, but
I also do want to say that, you know, Jamie Foxx might not be, I mean, he's not the best cab driver. He just gets lucky with the lights, which I like that he says that to both Jada Pinkett Smith and Tom Cruise. Like, oh, I just got lucky with the lights. Like, just trying to downplay, but like, he says it with a smile.
Yeah.
Like, he's trying to be humble, but also knows, like, he knows exactly, like, he is... you know, Tom Cruise, like, do you know what this address is? He's like, yeah, like, basically, like, of course I do. Like, yeah. I know exactly where that is.
Jamie Foxx is so good. Like, I mean, like, I grew up watching him, like, doing the comedian stuff and, like, his sitcom and things like that. But, like, when he came to feature films, like, it's such a different, it's such another, like, for him to be go toe-to-toe with Tom Cruise, like, I never doubt. You know what I'm saying? Like, it feels like he's been on screen for decades, like, doing this, like, you know, it just seems so natural. So, like, that as well, like, kind of blew me away again. I guess I don't really watch a lot of Jamie Foxx films. I don't know. Like, I've seen Ray and I've seen a few, but they just kind of elude me at the moment. But seeing this one and seeing how good he is, it's just like, I got to remember to keep an eye out for him more often.
You know, Mike, he's in a movie that has a particular connection to our most recent episode, I think, unless I'm conflating movies, our most recent episode of Grand Isle, because don't call Cage a jarhead, but isn't he in Jarhead? Wasn't that what Jesus Walks Us From? Wasn't that movie?
I have not seen... Have I seen Jarhead? I have not seen Jarhead.
I think that's right.
That's the Gyllenhaal movie? With Jake Gyllenhaal's?
Yeah, the Sam Mendes movie.
Oh, I have to see that.
Jarhead, yeah, Jamie Foxx, Jake Gyllenhaal, directed by Sam Mendes, yeah.
I just have to say there are four sequels and another one coming to Jarhead. I just want to throw that into the conversation.
Oh, yeah. I know. I knew there was at least... I knew that there was at least Jarhead 3 because I'm never going to do it on my show.
Wait,
ever.
What?
Yeah.
Yeah, it is the least sequelable movie ever, and it's the least like war movie ever. Like, it's a very, very cerebral kind of thing. And
wow, the fourth one came out this year.
Jarhead, right? Yeah. Or no, there's a
so there's Jarhead. Yeah. There's Jarhead 2: Field of Fire, which came out 9 years after the first in 2014. Then Jarhead 3: The Siege, which came out in 2016, and then Jarhead: Law of Return came out this year. And Don Michael Paul directed the second and the fourth one. It Guys, looks that... like they're totally wildly different casts in all of them, and none of the sequels have good ratings on Letterboxd.
No, none of them are good. I'm just pointing it out. That is
hey, I'm writing Jarhead 5.
Yeah.
By the way, guys, it's all said.
On their performances, two things I love about the performances in this movie from our two main actors is that Jamie Foxx is playing much more neurotic than his usual on-screen persona. Like, there's not a lot of swagger to him until that great scene where he has to go in to meet Javier Bardem get the information, pretending to be Vincent, because these guys don't know what Vincent looks like. And you get this great moment where he has to improvise in the having watched Tom Cruise, having watched Vincent for the first 2/3 of this movie, has to then like act like him. And you can see Jamie Foxx lock into, you know, the Jamie Foxx of their next collaboration, his next collaboration with Michael Mann of Miami Vice. Like, he clicks into the like tough guy character right before your eyes. And it shows the contrast to the way that his character is he's playing the character the rest of the movie. Like, he's playing an everyman here. And like, can be a hard thing for a movie star to do believably. And then Tom Cruise is internalizing so much of his outward madness and precision. And, you know, like there are a few times when there are times when he unleashes it as he becomes more and more unhinged. Joey, to your point about Michael Mann sending him around to try and be anonymous, he's swallowing so many of the tics that we're used to that we enjoy in the Tom Cruise performance, and having to find other ways to kind of prowl and menace. And you can feel all the rage and loathing and all the stuff inside, and like peeks out, and you go, oh my god, this guy's could snap at any minute. And then he does, and you're like, wow, I think this is a real testament to his ability as an actor to break some of the habits that he's used to relying on and sort of sublimate them and find new ways to get that information across, that feeling across to us. I think both of them are playing a little bit against type, and it works really well.
You know, there's one moment where all that comes together in Tom Cruise's performance, and that's when Jamie Foxx is like robbed by the Nazis, like, right? Like, there's a guy with like the swastika tattoo on his eye and his bald friend, and they come along and they rob him. And then Tom Cruise just comes down from killing a guy, and he's like, excuse me. And it's like, oh shit, you know, it's like, I just saw a ghost. Like, these guys have no fucking clue what they're dealing with. They, you know what I mean? And then, of course, they whip out their piece and they're like, what do you want, asshole? And like, Tom Cruise just dismantles them both like, you know, a ninja or whatever. He doesn't really show, you're right, Tobin, like, there's not like this buildup of like, they're throwing cans at him and he's taking it. He just calmly and like calculated, like walks up to super efficiently, just like almost like Ad Astra, like Joey, doesn't raise his heart rate whatsoever. Like, just keeps a baseline BPM, just like dismantles these guys and just like, here's your wallet, let's get going, I'm on my way. And it's just like, damn, that is fucking cold and scary when a person can just like go into that and like turn that on. I believe it is the scary thing.
Right.
You know, one thing that I didn't think about while watching this movie that this conversation has led me to think might be the case, and I don't know that necessarily matters whether or not this is true, maybe Tom Cruise becomes more animated and sort of more outward rather than inward as he realizes that in a certain light Jamie Foxx is his equal, not as a hitman, but in terms of being a professional. That I can see, you know, the Oakland thing where he has a cab driver, you know, there's three murders and then the guy, you know, takes his own life or whatever, supposedly, but we're led to believe that that's Tom Cruise doing the same thing there. Like, I can see this kind of professional, this kind of hitman going job to job and not ever being able to connect with someone because no one is on his level. And then to find someone, you know, even though he's a cab driver and not necessarily the glamorous, quote unquote, glamorous job of like a hitman, as he gets to know Jamie Foxx a little bit better, you know, even from the very first thing, like it's going to take me 7 minutes to get there, like knowing that this guy is as to the letter as he is in what he does, I wonder if that opens Cruise up. You know, I think it's an impossible question to answer unless we see him on other jobs from other movies that we don't, you know what I mean? But I wonder if his connection to this fellow professional in a different field helps him feel more at ease. And it's not only the fact that he's becoming more unhinged, things are not necessarily going as smoothly as he would like, but he's also like, oh, this is someone I can actually connect with until I inevitably kill him because I can't leave a trace.
I think you might actually be onto something there, because I got the sense during this movie that Tom Cruise at one point was starting to get frustrated with Jamie Foxx because he just wanted him to be the best version of himself, kind of thing. Because he's like, what do you mean you want to be a limo driver and you've been a cab driver for like 15 years? Like, get off the pot, like shit or get off the pot, you know? He's like, once he finds that out, it like sort of his impression of him takes a turn, and I think he gets more agitated because he's like, well, I thought this guy, you know, might have been sort of like a mental equal on that level, or like someone who takes pride in his craft, but it turns out no, he wants to do something else. Like, he's not happy with what he's doing, and I kind of don't like that about him, and it starts to like irk him and realize like, oh, things aren't exactly like, as I can't control everything, I'm not in control, and like he starts to lose his grip a little bit. And so I think he is challenged at some point by this cab driver, which has to be super frustrating for someone who thinks he's just, you know, the best at no matter what. Like, oh, I could probably drive a cab better than this guy because I'm the greatest hitman in the world kind of attitude is, that's how it kind of feels when he sits down in the back seat. But when, you know, when he's sitting there dying and bleeding out on the subway, it kind of seems like, good for you, kid. Like, you came out of your shell, you had the guts to do it, like, you took me out, and now you can go, like, live a life that's, like, worth something.
You know, I would love to see a movie where Tom Cruise is a cab driver. Actually, hold on, this is a good point to pivot where I can talk about the other people. Before we talk about the very few things that maybe we didn't like about this movie, here are some people that were originally considered for these parts. So just think about this in terms of the Tom Cruise, Jamie Foxx dynamic. Before Michael Mann was brought on, attached to this film, Spike Lee, Scorsese, and Spielberg were all offered the chance to direct, and they all either had a conflict or dropped out for one reason or another. Mimi Leder was initially attached to direct until it passed on to Janusz Kaminski. And then Russell Crowe, I think somebody brought in Russell Crowe where he was interested, because this was like on the shelf for a while, and Russell Crowe got interested in playing the Tom Cruise part, and so he, you know, gave the film some heat, not to use a Michael Mann pun, but then he brought on Michael Mann there, and then he had to drop out because there were constant delays, delay, delay, delay. Then when he fell out, Tom Cruise was brought on board, but the idea was Cruise as the Vincent role and Adam Sandler as the cab driver, which I think would also be fascinating. Especially as right now, as this episode comes out, it's now Uncut Gems season here in America. So just think about Adam Sandler as a driver. I think that would have been great. Edward Norton, Mike, our boy Edward Norton, offered both lead roles.
Whoa.
Wait, at the same time? Interesting. To play
that would be, that would have been amazing.
I wonder.
You could have Michelle Gondry direct that one.
Yeah, yeah.
Leonardo DiCaprio offered the Vincent role, but he was too busy shooting The Aviator.
I don't know if he's there yet. I could see him doing that
today. Doing it now, right? Yeah.
Yeah, it would be amazing. Yeah.
Rick fucking Dalton. Val Kilmer was cast as Detective Fanning, but had to pull out. I think Detective Fanning is the Ruffalo part.
Ruffalo, yeah.
Cuba met with Michael Mann about playing the driver, but he said, Michael Mann turned Cuba down because they'd already acted together in Jerry Maguire, and I guess he didn't want Michael Mann didn't want to rehash it, which I think is an interesting. John Travolta was considered for the role of Vincent.
Of course. Which is the third time I think that's come up. That would have been amazing still. Joey, did you by any chance go halfway through this movie trying to imagine that this is the same Vincent from The Color of Money who is
that he's played Vincent in two movies.
And he's just like screw pool. Somewhere during the 90s, everything fell apart, and he reemerged as like this hitman.
Also, I was trying to think if he was Vincent the dog from Lost.
Maybe in another life.
Colin Farrell offered the role of Vincent, who would go on. Tobin, you mentioned him earlier. He would play Crockett in Miami Vice with Jamie Foxx and Michael Mann. And the only other one is that Johnny Depp was briefly considered for the role of Max for the Jamie Foxx role. I don't think that works. I don't think Johnny Depp in that role works well. But I also think that Johnny Depp has led us all collectively down a path where I can't envision him necessarily in any role that's not supremely weird.
I think I'm kind of good with Johnny Depp for now. I don't really need. I've had enough for a while.
I think that's probably true of a lot of people. Now, Tobin.
Yeah.
On the other side of the coin, we have given off so much praise for this movie. Is there something about this that doesn't work? Is there something about this movie that you think that you would change or swap out or remove or alter? What is your least favorite part of Collateral?
You know, there's not much. I wouldn't change much about this movie. I am made a little uncomfortable by Jada Pinkett Smith's damsel in distress, that being sort of the final act. I know you need that in the movie. She's not completely helpless, but it is, I think, a real blind spot in Michael Mann. Even if you made the Mark Ruffalo detective a woman, or I feel like you could they could have populated this movie with a few more women, and I think it would have been the movie would have been better for it. So that's maybe my my contender's hat criticism of this movie, is that there aren't enough sort of featured women in the movie.
Yeah, we only get the one SWAT member, right? There's one female SWAT team member, and then there's the two guy, the one guy I recognize from everything, and then two or three other guys who I can't quite place. But yeah, she was the only other woman that I noticed in the entire movie, pretty much. Wasn't just a background extra or something.
Right.
I agree with that. I think I would like to see more women here. I think the difficulty here is that even if you have, Mark Ruffalo be a woman, there's this movie is really just two people, right? It's Cruise and it's Jamie Foxx. Everyone else, Jada Pinkett Smith is third build. I think Ruffalo is probably fourth, but they're on screen for maybe 10 minutes, 8 minutes, 10 minutes. I think that there's opportunity for more of that.
That's all I'm asking for, is more of that.
Yeah, I think it's just, it's difficult for anybody to really sort of be able to compare to the two lead, because they have so much time on screen.
Yeah. And I'm not asking to a wholesale thing. I just think, and even if I just saw this movie, I might not really feel that way, but it makes me a conflicted Michael Mann fan. I'm such a fan of his movies, and he has maybe two female characters who I can really get behind, and neither of them are in this movie. And so I think it's me looking more sort of holistically at his work. I don't know what you would change in this movie. I think it's just so rich.
I mean, there's room. I mean, this is a 2-hour movie, but I sat down and watched it straight through with no breaks. I just coasted right through this thing. I was just gripped by it. And I was I could take an extra 10-15 minutes if we need to flesh out Jada Pinkett Smith at the office, or you know what I'm saying? Do more cop things and have them try and contact her, or have her have to fight someone. Regardless, even though it's a long movie, it's not one I was complaining about. I was give me more of this movie, squeeze more of that stuff in. Maybe, next time.
Is that what you would fix too? Is that your least favorite part, Mike? Or is there something else that you would point out?
No, so there is almost Apollo 13. There's literally one moment in this movie that I just can't. It just my eyes can't roll far. It's that George Clooney gift, from Ocean's 13, where it just the eye or 12, where the eyes roll so hard, and it comes right after one of the coolest moments that I thought was so poignant. And it's towards the end, and they're sitting there in the cab, and everybody's really weary, and I think they're off to their last. I think it's right before he crashes the cab, maybe. They're sitting at a light, and they see the coyote in the street, right? That's a coyote, right?
Yeah,
that's what that is?
Yes.
I wasn't sure if it was a wolf or a coyote. Okay. I was oh, that's awesome, because that's you could make a case for it being either of them. And then the whole moment is ruined when the song plays. And it's you gotta be fucking kidding me. You're gonna play the hit single music video drop right now? You're gonna play this somber, introspective, thoughtful, the whole movie has not been going in that direction. Just let it sit there. Let it be in silence. Let them have the moment. And I was just so disappointed that they couldn't help themselves, or they had to do that, or whatever. It just felt in an otherwise movie that was like so close to perfect. It's like, damn it, that really just took me out of it, you know. I was like right after a really cool shot and really cool thing, and it's just boom, this song just kind of hit me. I was like, but and that's literally like one of the only other things I can think of that like about this movie that just like isn't great.
I agree with you. It is a tick of of Michael Mann that sometimes works really well, and sometimes his taste is maybe a little off in terms of the moment or the tune. Yeah, I wouldn't mind that being a little altered there too. Yeah, because you're right, that moment, the moment is so good, and that says it all that you need to say.
There's also, I think, a Navajo saying that if you go down a path and you see a coyote cross the street, like, or you cross in front of you, you turn around, you go back, but there's no, like, nothing good is going to come after that.
Oh, it's like a point of no return kind of
exactly
situation.
It's just like happened, let's not tempt fate, let's go back. The one moment, I think it's, again, maybe you could convince me that this is good, but I think early on, I think after Tom Cruise kills the first guy and Jamie Foxx is basically trying to figure out the why of Tom Cruise, and Tom Cruise says something about, like, he references the Rwandan genocide, and is like, do you care about those people? There's tens of thousands of people killed before the sun comes up, and like, you're not crying a tear over those. It's just like, well, what? Like, I don't, what?
It is kind of like just, yeah, pick an atrocity out of a hat point moment kind of thing. I've wondered, is this all scripted, or did they have any time to like play around? Because I wonder if that was born out of like sitting in the back seat for hours, like going over dialogue, trying to punch stuff up to be more spontaneous and stuff, because that did feel kind of like a thing that someone would just sort of like talk out of their ass about or something, you know, like bullshit about, or like not exactly know what he's talking about, but just like, oh, I have a strong example, maybe he'll concede to my point if I sound like I know what I'm talking about. I don't know, but I did like most of the rest of the banter.
They did a lot of rehearsals for this movie, and on the DVD that I have, you can see some of the footage that Michael Mann shot with his little mini DV camera of, like, he's like looking for angles as they're running the scenes in a cab that's not moving. They're just sort of in their street clothes running scenes, and apparently what they would do is they would run the scenes on the script, and then they would make improv things, then make changes, and then Stuart Beatty, I never know how to say his name, the writer, would go back and like incorporate that stuff into the script, and they bring new pages and they do it again. So they sort of workshopped the movie, so it was very scripted, but some of the lines came out of their rehearsals, like out of sort of an improvisational process, and then they would be reincorporated into a script.
That's cool. I like that.
I wonder, do either of you know how long this took to shoot, how many weeks they did to shoot this movie? Because it feels like it could have been either forever or like a very
like
short
a
amount of time.
Yeah,
I get more the sense that it didn't take too long. Like, it feels like something they just like blew through almost, and like, you know, tried to capture like lightning in a bottle or that kind of thing, where it's like, don't think too much about it, like, let's just go out there with all these new digital cameras and just shoot and like get what we get, and then like go back and like let's just put out what we get, and like that, you know what I mean, like that kind of filming, like, let's not think too much about it, like, let's just do what we're doing and get it over with and get it done, and not to say like let's rush it, but like stick to the plan and don't get too off track. And it just feels like that type of production.
Do your prep, get it ready, and then go just get it done. It does feel like the ethos of the movie.
I know that there was a scene, like, I can't find how long it took to shoot, but I know that there was a scene where Mark Ruffalo first realizes the connection between it all. I think this is probably either the morgue or right around the time of the morgue. They apparently did like 80 or more takes of that. Like, whoa. It was just one of those, like, you had to break him down to like get him to actually have that kind of like breakthrough, sort of. That maybe indicates that it wasn't necessarily like a breezy shoot, like just like, hey, we're gonna be in here for a while, you know what I mean? But it does kind of feel like, okay, let's just go around, like, let's strap a camera in the let's strap cameras all over the cab and just go around for a night and just see what we get and then go from there. Like, I don't think it's that loosey-goosey, but it also feels like it almost could have been, and it's a testament to the type of movie that it is.
Also, it's going to take longer, maybe because they're working out new technology too.
True, that's very true. Do either of you have anything else to say? There's a couple other notes that I want to make note of, but I will mention them in the awards ceremony. But I probably have a little bit more trivia. But is there anything else that you guys want to talk about? You want to bring up before we play a couple games and nominate this for some awards?
I love it.
Yeah, no, me neither. I'm definitely gonna rewatch this one soon.
When at the end of the movie, where Tom Cruise is chasing Jamie Foxx and Jada Pinkett Smith through that office building, and he throws the chair through the glass door, and then he tries to run through it and he, like, trips over the chair.
Yeah.
Wasn't supposed to trip, but he actually did trip, and they kept it in there. So I guess he is not infallible in action scenes. Michael Mann used to drive a cab, as did his father, and his grandfather owned a cab company, so there was a history there. I guess that's why. Originally, Vincent's name, Tom Cruise's character's name, was Vincent Collateral, which...
No.
Not a great name.
No.
When this movie was coming out just a few years earlier in 2002, I think, Collateral Damage, the Schwarzenegger movie, came out and kind of bombed. Okay. And people were wondering whether or not they should call this movie Collateral because they were afraid of it being tied in some kind of way in people's minds to that movie. And they basically decided, let's not get rid of a name that we love because a movie that has nothing to do with our movie didn't do well, which I think is the right choice to make.
And it didn't end up hurting it at all either. No one remembered Collateral Damage.
Right.
The sunglasses, this is important, we might nominate this later. The sunglasses Tom Cruise wears are the Silhouette 4048s. So if you want to look like him in this movie, dye your hair gray and do the Silhouette 4048s.
It's good cosplay.
Yeah, it's not too... You get just a nice-looking gray suit, beautiful head of hair, gray, and then, you know, just carry around that, like, briefcase.
There's almost like a... I wonder if you picked up something from working with John Woo, because there's a very Hong Kong sort of action gun style to this character specifically. Like, even though all white, like, a lot of sort of, like, the Merchant of Death style gun fu killers, like, wear all white instead of black in those types of movies and things. So, like, I was picking up on some of those sort of, like... influences and stuff.
Speaking of John Woo, especially speaking of Mission Impossible 2, I was getting flashbacks of the first Mission Impossible when he jumps onto that train at the end. I was like, oh.
Yeah.
Very important question. I know the answer to both of these questions already, but I wanted to ask both of you first. Does Tom Cruise run in this movie? Resounding, absolutely,
he does.
Definitely does.
Maybe a more difficult question, but I think the answer, once again, obviously, is yes. We found Harper Fecht on Twitter, who said that you could replace Tom Cruise's name in any movie with the name Lightning McQueen and not a thing would change. Here's my rationale. Vincent isn't necessarily his name. Like, it's just a name, right? Like, he can have a different name in every city. I think it's probably his name, but it also doesn't matter. If he introduced himself to Jamie Foxx as, hey, I'm Lightning McQueen, he'd be like, all right. So I say absolutely yes, but I want to hear your... I know, Mike, you're generally with me here. I know it's sort of a tougher sell for the guest from week to week, but Tobin, do you think that he could play Lightning McQueen in this movie, or is that a name that just makes no sense within the context of Collateral?
Yeah, I don't buy it as his name in the movie, but I wonder if you could take the name Vincent Collateral and give him that name in every other movie that he's been in.
Gotta restart. Wait, Mike, what were we restarting? Oh, we were restarting Hanks for the Memories to see if he pees in every movie, and we're restarting this to see if Vincent Collateral works, so, you know, we'll scrap the last year of work and just, you know, start over.
Yeah, start over, yeah.
I think he could get away with being called Mr. McQueen a lot in this, and then like halfway through he reveals that his first name is Lightning, and that's part of like his trauma and why he's like such a killer. It's like a boy named Sue complex that he has, kind of thing. And it's like, I don't make me tell you my first name, I kill, like, I tell you my name, I have to kill you. So yes, I think it would work.
Thank you. That's I was just waiting, I was leaving a dramatic pause for you to say yes. All right, so the Tom Cruise Awards, we still don't have a name for them. Maybe the Collaterals, probably not. Best film for sure, Collateral.
Yeah, dude. I mean, there's so many good ones, but like this is up there, man.
You know, I'm gonna take out now. I know that we have like a dozen people nominated, but I'm gonna take out Best Director Filmmaker just because it's not Cruise related and we have too many other things. I'm just gonna goodbye. I'm so sorry, but you're all gone. Vincent in Collateral, best role, I think, for sure. And most badass role as well.
I would think so. I mean, he does so much with this role. I don't know how you could. I mean, I think it stacks up really well with a lot of his other iconic roles.
I'd love to see him fight himself from The Last Samurai, because like that's the other big badass role that recently that I really love.
Now, here is an important question, and I think this is, you know, it sort of piggybacks off what Tobin just said in a way. Is this one of Tom Cruise's most daring roles to take? I mean, it's, I think, somehow simultaneously both firmly in his wheelhouse and also wildly out of his wheelhouse. Is this one of the most daring roles that he's taken?
It was considered that way at the time. There was a lot of question about him playing Gray, him playing the killer, him being the heavy in the movie. Whether it is in retrospect, I'm not sure, but it certainly was at the moment.
It's tough because, like, I remember when this came out, I was like, oh, like, evil Cruise? Like, that's interesting. But it was still more like I equated him in this picture to be like Action Cruise. Like, I thought when this came out, it was more like an action film until I first saw it, really, you know? And so I think just in that regard, to me, it's not as daring as like what he did with Magnolia, you know? Like,
right,
I think that is something where it's like he really fucking swung and put his career kind of on the line, like, between that and Eyes Wide Shut. And, like, I think Magnolia, his performance is way more successful. I think it's just, you know, comes much more alive in that film. You know, yeah, this is, there's a lot of stuff going for this and everything, but I just think Magnolia is the harder performance and the more daring and the more sort of like naked performance, if you will, or something like that. You know, like he seems like he's got a grip on this. Like he could play this all day, and I'd love to see him play this all day. Whereas Magnolia, I feel like he's got maybe two or three of those in him.
That's true. It's a good point.
I agree with everything you said. I am still going to put it on the list, if only because we only have four other nominees, and I would like to have a round number five. But I agree it's not as, I think it's more daring than a lot of what he does. But yeah. I don't think it's as daring as Eyes Wide Shut, Magnolia, what you were mentioning just now.
I'll be prepared to remake that argument at the end of the run.
Best fight. Is there a specific fight? I mean, is there a fist fight? I mean, he just kind of shoots dudes.
Yeah, but the fights maybe in the club, the John Wick scene where he's like taking out the guys in hand-to-hand combat. Because then you get to see him, you know he knows hand-to-hand combat. He's not just a gunslinger.
I just don't think it's going to win. I think you're going to have so many more other options that maybe this is one where you don't put it on. Not because it's not good, but just because it takes a back seat to some other things in this movie.
Taxi cab pun. But, best theme song soundtrack score. I think it's great in here, but I was also thinking as I was listening to the score, because I there were certain things where I was like, oh, this is so cool. I don't know that a score is ever really going to win this category, Mike. I think we're going to remember sort of like juking box musicals. I think it's going to be like, you know, Magnolia. It's going to be Risky Business. It's going to be movies where, you know, Top Gun, where it's like, oh, I know exactly, like, yeah, I need Danger Zone, right? Like, I think that's what's going to
sound
like a cool, throbbing, pulsing, you know, score here. I think it's great, but I don't know that it's necessarily going to hold up. So I think in that regard, going to skip it.
Until you get to Rock of Ages, obviously.
I mean,
of course. Stacey Jacks, right? Is that his name?
Yep, it is. Yep. With two E's.
Best
two
car
X's.
Chase slash... Are you going to be on that? Is that you
in
Iceland?
No, I don't think so. I've never seen it.
Oh, no, you are. I recruited you because Iceland's on that episode. It's you in Iceland, so you're going to watch it with us for the first time, because I've never seen it either.
Here we go.
Best car chase race. He doesn't drive. I think I'm going to exclude this one. But, you know, if we had a foot race. I mean, there's a running scene, which we're going to get to. There's a foot race. There's a great foot race here, but we'll get to the running scene later. Best dance scene? I don't think he dances.
No. He's at a club, but he's not dancing.
Best cruise outfit wardrobe. Looking good, but I don't think it's spectacular.
No, it's more like innocuous, right? It's like not to stand out.
Right.
Best sunglasses I will put on here just because I think it is a... Best death... shot and killed by Jamie Foxx.
And then left on the subway as per his earlier anecdote about the guy who died on the subway. So I think it's pretty poetic too.
Now, best line, this is something that I was saving. I think there's a line he says toward the end when he is in full Terminator mode where he says to Jamie Foxx, "Max, I do this for a living. Like, why are you messing with me right now? You know who I am. You know what I do. Stop it." And I think I do this for a living, not necessarily as iconic as other of his quotes, but I think for this movie, you know, I think it's one that's worth noting.
Absolutely.
That's a great line, yeah.
Best freak out? I mean, that's maybe more of a freak out, but I'll just leave it in best line. Best sex scene? Nope, not in this movie. Most athletic feat? He does jump. If he jumped onto the subway car, I think that'd be one. But he does like a jump where he jumps basically across the entire width of a subway car, like when he gets on the back, like it's not as spectacular as other things he's done, but man, it's a long jump.
That alone, but also just the stamina to take out five people in one night just seems like a lot to do in one night. You know, like this guy is just on mission, like he's up for it too. He's like, "Hey man, I had a great dinner. Like I'm good to go. Like I'm gonna go kill five. I could kill six people. Oh, I might even kill seven." And he does. He kills like extra people. But then he does, like, at the end of it, after he's all beat the shit and stuff, too, he has, like, a superhuman jump onto the subway, so...
Best or worst love story? No. Oh, best running scene, though, chasing Jamie Foxx through Los Angeles. Best ensemble cast? I'm gonna say...
Not enough people,
it's
right?
It's not really an ensemble. They're not so together.
Yeah.
It's a great cast, but...
Best non-cruise actor, male or female, do we want to nominate Jamie Foxx?
I mean, it's either him or the rough, and I think I want to give it to Jamie Foxx, to be honest. Yeah. This is almost his movie, right? Like, I almost got a sense at times where, like, Tom Cruise, it almost seems like, not that he's, like, shepherding or anything like that or mentoring, but it just seemed like, here's an actor in Jamie Foxx who's, like, up and coming, and, like, I kind of want to help this guy, or, like, be in a movie with this guy because I recognize ability and stuff. And so, like, there's just this, like, common ground I sense between them, you know, like, respect. Yeah. And, like, of Tom Cruise being so seasoned at this point and Jamie Foxx being so sort of new, there's just kind of, like, unusual. I don't know. I don't really get that energy a lot. So it was really nice to see that. And it is a little weird that, you know, a few years later, Jamie Foxx will date his ex-wife. Can't forget happening.
I think we have, unless I'm doing this wrong, 12 nominees. Best film, best role. Oh, wait, no, it's going to be less than that. Best film, best role, most badass role, most daring role to take, best sunglasses, best death, best line, best running scene, and best non-Cruise actor male for Jamie Foxx in Collateral. Very, nice. Very good,
good
showing.
Good stuff, yeah.
9 nominations. Very, very good. Very, very impressive. Next week, Mike, you and I over on Hank's Memories covering a little movie called Toy Story, which, woo, very exciting. And then 2 weeks here, we are going back another Channing Tatum movie, although not exactly. We'll be covering the next episode of Crucible. We'll be covering War of the Worlds, a movie where Channing Tatum is supposedly in, spoiler alert, not actually in, but there is another full episode of Magic Mike's about that one too. So, you know, Magic Mike's may be dead, but I'm glad that we did an entire episode about a movie that Channing Tatum is not in. Tobin, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I think you won't be back again until Rock of Ages. Thank you for joining us. And if you wanted to tell our listeners one more time about the contenders and what movie will be coming out as this episode comes out, I think next Tuesday or maybe in 2 Tuesdays.
A show with my sister called The Contenders about movies made by and or starring women who refuse to play by the rules. And our next episode comes out. We come out
last Tuesday.
It's the last Tuesday, right? So it's so it's New Year's Eve. We're going to have an episode December 31st on Frozen 2. Take your kids or your nieces or your nephews or yourselves or your significant others to go check out Frozen 2 and then come listen to our show on the 31st.
And journey into the unknown.
Into the unknown, indeed.
And let it snow, right? Let it snow, guys.
Yes. But for all things Cruise Club, you can go to cageclub.me, facebook.com/cageclub, or at cageclubpod on Twitter and Instagram. Email us, run@cageclub.me. Come back next week over on Hank's the Memories for Toy Story. Come back here in 2 weeks for War of the Worlds. You know, we are in the back half of Cruise Club. I think it's Cruise Club is tentatively scheduled to wrap up in July or August of next year. So there's not that much more just because Tom Cruise has not done that many. But we have 1,350-something episodes at cageclub.me/shows. Go check out all 26 programs, including, I mentioned on this episode, a new episode of Cage Club this month, a new episode of Viva Pod Vegas, and actually, as this episode comes out, there's a chance this weekend another episode of Viva Pod Vegas about Jailhouse Rock might be just around the corner, unless schedules do not align. But just throwing that out there, get ready for even more Elvis Presley film coverage, for some reason, from me and Mike. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
And that was Tobin Addington of the Contenders Podcast, and we'll see you next time right here on Cruise Club.